News of the literary lion-hunting sex life of Yezhov's wife, Yevgenia, suddenly reached Stalin. Sholokhov, one of his favourite novelists, had started an affair with her. Yezhov bugged Sholokhov's room at the National Hotel and was furious to read the transcript. He was so intoxicated and jealous that he slapped Yevgenia in the presence of a houseguest, with whom he was sleeping, but later forgave his wife. Sholokhov realized he was being followed and complained to Stalin and Beria. Stalin summoned Blackberry to the Politburo, where he apologized to the novelist. When Yezhov arrested one commissar, Stalin sent Molotov and Mikoyan to investigate. Back at the Kremlin, Mikoyan acclaimed the man's innocence, and Beria attacked Yezhov's case. Stalin released the commissar, who became what Mikoyan called a lucky stiff, back from the dead. When one NKVD officer needed the chief signature, Yezhov was nowhere to be found. Beria told him to drive out to Yezhov's dacha. There, the officer found a man who had spent the night drinking heavily. Regional NKVD bosses started to denounce Yezhov. The darkness began to descend on Yezhov's family. His silly, sensual wife was unwittingly to play the terrible role of Black Widow Spider. Most of her lovers were to die. Both she and Yezhov were promiscuous, but then they lived in a world of high tension and dynamic turmoil, where men rose and fell around them. If there was justice in Yezhov's fall, it was a tragedy for Yevgenia and little Natasha, to whom he was a kind father. Yezhov learned that Beria was going to use Yevgenia against him, so he asked for a divorce. This was sensible. In other cases, it actually saved the life of the divorcee, but the tension almost broke the nervy Yevgenia, who went on holiday to the Crimea to recover. It seems that Yezhov was trying to protect his wife from arrest, hence her loving and grateful letter to him. Kolyushenka, I earnestly beg you to check up on my whole life, everything about me. I cannot reconcile myself to the thought that I am under suspicion of committing crimes I never committed. Their world was shrinking daily. Another of her ex-lovers, the publisher Uritsky, was being interrogated. He revealed her affair with the writer Isaac Babil. Yezhov's secretary and friends were arrested too. Yezhov summoned Yevgenia back to Moscow. Yevgenia waited at their dacha with her daughter Natasha and a friend, Zineida. Yevgenia was desperately worried about the family. Her nerves cracked, and she was sent to a sanatorium near Moscow. When Zineida was arrested, Yevgenia wrote to Stalin, "I beg you, Comrade Stalin, to read this letter. I am treated by professors, but what sense does it make if I am burned by the thought that you distrust me? You are dear and beloved to me." Swearing on her daughter's life that she was honest, she admitted that, "In my personal life there have been mistakes." Stalin doubtless already knew. She made the sacrificial offer. "Let them take away my freedom, my life, but I will not give up the right to love you as everybody does who loves the country and the party." She signed off. "I feel like a living corpse. What am I to do?" Stalin did not reply. The trap was swinging shut on Yevgenia and her Kolyushenka. At the 7th of November parade, Yezhov appeared on the mausoleum but lingered behind Stalin. Then he disappeared and was replaced by Beria in the blue cap and uniform of a commissar first class of state security. When Stalin ordered the arrest of Yezhov's friend, Uspensky, the Ukrainian NKVD chief, the dwarf forewarned him. Uspensky faked suicide and went on the run. Stalin, probably rightly, suspected that Yezhov was bugging his phones. On the 17th of November, a Politburo commission denounced very serious faults in the work of the NKVD. The deadly troikas were dissolved. Stalin and Molotov signed a report, disassociating themselves from the terror. In her own way, Yevgenia loved Yezhov, despite all their infidelities, and adored their daughter Natasha, because she was willing to sacrifice herself to save them. Sergo's widow visited her in hospital, an heroic act of loyalty. Yevgenia gave her a letter for Yezhov, in which she offered to commit suicide and asked for a sleeping draught. She suggested that he send a little statuette of a gnome when the time came. He sent Luminal. Then, a little later, he ordered the maid to take his wife the statuette. Given Yezhov's dwarfish stature, this deadly gnome seems farcical. Perhaps the statuette was an old keepsake, representing darling Kolya himself from the early days of their romance. Yevgenia sent a note bidding Yezhov goodbye, and took the luminal. Isaac Barbil heard that Stalin can't understand her death. His own nerves are made of steel, so he just can't understand how, in other people, they give out. The Yezhov's adopted daughter Natasha, 9, was sent to one of those grim orphanages for the children of enemies. 2 days after Yevgenia's death, Yezhov underwent 4 hours of criticism from Stalin, Molotov, and Voroshilov, after which he resigned from the NKVD. Yet he remained in limbo as CC secretary, commissar of water transport, and a candidate Politburo member, living in the Kremlin like a tiny ghost, experiencing what his victims had known before him, and consoling himself with a series of drunken bisexual orgies. Beria, whom Stalin nicknamed the prosecutor, was triumphantly appointed commissar on the 25th of November, and summoned his Georgian henchmen to Moscow. Beria's courtiers were much more educated than Kaganovich or Voroshilov, but education is no bar to barbarism. The arrival of these exotic, strutting Georgians, some even convicted murderers, must have been like Pancho Villa and his banditos riding into a northern town in one of Beria's favorite movies. Stalin later made a great play of sending some of them home, replacing them with Russians, but he remained very much a Georgian himself. Beria's men gave Stalin's entourage a distinctly Caucasian flavor. Stalin was careful not to place himself completely in the hands of Beria. He appointed his personal bodyguard, Vlasik, to the sensitive job of chief of his personal security, which included overseeing the duchess, food for the kitchens, the carpool, and millions of rubles. Henceforth, Stalin ruled through Paskryobyshev in political matters and Vlasik in personal ones. Both were indefatigably industrious and sleazy. Vlasik was doggedly loyal, uneducated, and drunkenly dissolute. An insatiable womanizer, he had so many concubines he forgot their names, and sometimes managed to have a different one in each room at his orgies. He called Stalin Comrade Stalin, rarely joining him at table. Paskryobyshev's social status was higher, often joining the magnates at dinner and calling Stalin Yosef Vissarionovich. He sat doggedly at his desk outside Stalin's office, the little corner which was his domain. The magnates cultivated him, playing to his vanity so that he would warn them if Stalin was in a bad mood. He was so powerful that he could even insult the Politburo. This faithful shield-bearer played his role in Stalin's most mundane deeds and the most terrible, boasting later about their use of poison. Paskryobyshev worked closely with Beria. They often visited each other's families, but if there was business to conduct, they walked in the garden. Ultimately, both Vlasik and Paskryobyshev were obstacles to Beria's power. The same could no longer be said of the Aleluyev family. All our family, wrote Svetlana, was completely baffled as to why Stalin made Beria, a provincial secret policeman, so close to him. The precise reason was that no one was sacred to Beria. The magnates and retainers all grumbled constantly about the self-importance of the aunties. Impertinent with his new power and burning with the inferiority complex of a scorned provincial, Beria was determined to prove himself by destroying these glamorous but snobbish members of the new nobility.